Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
So what do you think the environmental impact would be on a Brooklyn neighborhood of adding 16 high-rise buildings spread over 22 acres, comprised of 8.7 million square feet of office, commercial, and residential space, plus an arena for the basketball Nets? Well, that development project is, of course, the controversial Atlantic Yards plan for Prospect Heights, Brooklyn, centered around Atlantic and Flatbush Avenues. And yesterday was a day all sides in that high-stakes real estate battle were waiting for, the day the Pataki administration released its draft environmental impact statement. As it turned out, the statement, along with some other documents released, seem almost as big as the project itself, about 4,000 pages in this document drop. So all sides are still sifting through it this morning for nuggets of understanding, not to mention data they can use for media spin and for the eventual lawsuits everyone expects to be filed. So again, what do you think the environmental impact would be on a Brooklyn neighborhood of adding 16 high-rise buildings spread over 22 acres, comprised of 8.7 million square feet of office, commercial, and residential space, plus an arena for the basketball Nets? Well, according to the first impressions of these 4,000 pages, not much. A little more traffic, some more need for classroom space, a few new shadows where there used to be sun, and a bit of a strain on the water and sewage systems, but nothing that can't be accommodated, and nothing that will prevent the project from being a tax revenue winner for the people of the city, even after the tax incentives and infrastructure spending this new little city within a city will require. That's if you believe the Pataki administration's report, which organized opponents of the project certainly do not. We will get both sides in just a minute. The report also reveals at least one other thing, though, that I want to mention. The state has laid out in writing a justification for using eminent domain to complete the project if necessary, that is, using government power to force people to sell land for the project, even if they don't want to. The justification: the area is plagued with blight. Now to the two sides. First, an opponent of the project today, Jeff Baker, an attorney for the group Develop Don't Destroy Brooklyn, or DDDB, opposed to this project, and he's also a partner at the law firm of Young and Summer. Jeff Baker, welcome to WNYC. Good morning.
Morning. Thanks for having me.
Let's begin with this question of eminent domain. According to the New York Sun today, but why don't you talk about how you understand the rationale? If they say blight, if they say the area is blighted, if they say this is, you know, development for the neighborhood and for the city, what do you say?
Well, it isn't. And we have, there's a very extensive, or let me say it's long anyway, blight study attached to these documents. We have not had a chance to thoroughly review that. We've only given it a very preliminary review, but it's obviously flawed. What they're counting primarily, or some element of blight, is the Vanderbilt Yard rail yard. Well, I'm not sure that qualifies as blight because it's an active use by the MTA and the Long Island Railroad, and there's been no effort by any state or city authority for at least the last 30 years to try and develop those. So it's simply, it could be also be considered as an asset in some place where there can be redevelopment and can be used. The surrounding neighborhood, while there's certainly buildings in there that have not been utilized, it really doesn't qualify as blight, since prior to the announcement of this project, many of the buildings were being redeveloped on their own with private financing, not relying on state and state incentives. And obviously, ever since the project was developed, any other private development has been halted, and Forest City Ratner has purchased many of the buildings and is letting them to, you know, decay and rot. So in many instances, it's sort of considered developer's blight. We're going to look into it a lot more carefully, but it really seems like a completely artificial construct.
Now I have that Sun article from today, which says the causes of the area's blight, according to the report, include the presence of the rail yards and a, quote, diversity of ownership that, quote, hindered site assemblage that is necessary for redevelopment. And it quotes,
well, that's sort of a catch-22, isn't it? Because they're saying we want to create a big project because we have this vision for an arena, but we can't do it because, you know, unfortunately, a lot of people own it and they may not want to sell it to us. That's not blight. That just means that there's not enough properties there that Mr. Ratner can acquire on his own, so he needs the state to help him.
It also says the blight study was, quote, characterized by blighted conditions, or the neighborhood was characterized by blighted conditions, including structurally unsound buildings, debris-filled vacant lots, environmental concerns, high crime rates, and underutilization. So I'm quoting from the report, and I think you really already gave your responses to where you think that stuff comes from. But the Sun article also says the issue of blight in eminent domain will probably be central to any litigation that will be brought against the project. Do you expect it to be central?
Yes.
Why?
Well, it goes to, you know, the whole impetus for the project and their ability to go forward. And an important point to make, while ESDC has to determine blight to exercise its eminent domain powers, it has to find blight in the first instance to exercise its powers to even be there and usurp the New York City approvals and the local zoning. To be able to fit under a state project and qualify as an economic development project, they have to first determine that this area effectively is blighted and it requires the intervention of the state and its ability to override local zoning and approvals to go forward with the project. So even if eminent domain wasn't an element of this project, they would have to find blight to go forward to create something, which is something like 10 times the permissible zoning in terms of density.
Before we go on to the question of environmental impact, I just want to ask you a political question. This is the lame duck Pataki administration saying all this. Do you have any reason to believe that if you delay this all past January, an Elliot Spitzer administration, if he's the next governor, would reverse the findings of this environmental impact statement?
Well, he's already been generally supportive of the project, except I think we can trust that he's going to be a little more honest in the assessment of the subsidies that are involved here and the relative benefits that are claimed versus the clear adverse impacts are going to be suffered. And will, you know, if he's a man of his word in terms of cleaning up the corruption of the current administrations and the cronyism that's involved, you know, while everybody is in favor of redevelopment of the area and providing affordable housing, it's all an issue of scale. And what we don't have here from Ratner, and the document is completely silent on, is what's driving the overall scale of this project? What is the total amount of subsidies that are coming from the government? And what's the profit element that Ratner is getting, which, you know, determines the, you know, the enormous scale of this project, which creates all the impacts.
You talk about the subsidies. One of these documents also says that even after the tax incentives, even after the infrastructure improvements, there's still going to be over, I think the figure is, $1 billion in net tax revenue to the city as a result of the economic activity that this will all generate. Do you dispute that?
Yeah, we think it's probably highly inflated. We have to run the numbers and see if they've provided the sufficient numbers to calculate all of that. But you look at some of their figures for job creation, and they talk about, I think, 15,000 jobs being created. Well, it's not 15,000 jobs.
They say an annual average of 6,500 new jobs.
Yeah, well, there's really no backup to support where that is, and we think that's a highly inflated number.
Is there common ground to be found, maybe having something to do with the size of the project? I heard you emphasizing size there rather than stopping it.
Well, we've never said that there shouldn't be any development in the area. Develop Don't Destroy Brooklyn is fully supportive of redeveloping the Vanderbilt Yards and help develop the alternative plans that provide affordable housing, tax revenues, and redevelopment for the area, but does not use eminent domain and respects the scale of the neighborhood. There's no question that there's an opportunity with government subsidies to improve the area. That's not the issue. The issue is this ridiculous scale that's being proposed on a project where you've got a chosen developer instead of, when you're making this a state project, looking at it as a blank slate and say, well, what would be appropriate here? Instead of trying to shoehorn in this monstrosity that is one individual's vision.
Jeff Baker, attorney for Develop Don't Destroy Brooklyn and a partner in Young & Summer, my first guest on WNYC as we talk about the draft environmental impact statement for the Atlantic Yards project released by the state yesterday, as well as some other documents. We'll talk with Jim Stuckey in a few minutes, president of the Atlantic Yards Development Group. And Jeff Baker, let's go on to the question of environmental impact. There are questions about traffic, classroom space, shadows, and water and sewage strain. What's your reaction to the report? It seems to conclude that none of those things are a really big deal.
Yeah, well, that's obviously their perspective. They also don't give much information on what the mitigation is going to be, and much of what they present really just doesn't make any sense. I mean, they recognize, I believe, that there are going to be 66 intersections that are going to have significant impacts at one time or another from traffic impacts from the project. And they list a variety of mitigation measures, but no assurances that any of those will actually be implemented. And in various instances, they say they have not had the agreement from the appropriate agencies to implement those programs. They make the, frankly, ridiculous statements that, you know, adding, I forget how many residents we're having here, 15,000 or so, to the project area, the arena, and everything else will not be an increased demand on police or fire services. That defies credibility. They recognize that there will be a significant impact and an overcrowding of schools at full build-out, particularly the elementary and intermediate schools, but don't propose anything to deal with that. You can't simply say, well, we know there's going to be a significant impact and not do anything about it. That's burying your head in the sand.
Is that their job? People build housing in all kinds of neighborhoods all the time. People move to all kinds of neighborhoods all the time, making them more dense than they were in the past in some cases. And it's not their responsibility under the law, is it, to provide for new schools specifically?
Actually, sometimes it is. And what you look at is the question is when you're giving an approval and a discretionary approval is what is the impact on community facilities and can it be mitigated? In this case, again, this is a state and government project. It is not just a private project going forward where you've got the significant subsidies and you're overriding the local approvals. And so it's incumbent upon the state and the city, if they think that it is a fine project to provide all these benefits to the area and build this, to fully consider the costs associated with it and then make the allowances for the additional educational needs. I mean, New York City's in the whole fight with the fiscal equity lawsuit on the question of adequate funding for New York City schools. Why exacerbate that now with state funding that's going to increase density and not have any means to deal with that increased pressure on the city schools?
The release of this report begins a public comment period for 60 days. How can people comment?
Well, that's a good question because it's a grossly inadequate public comment period. They have the opportunity to comment in writing by sending their comments to ESDC. I think the deadline is September 23rd, and there's been a public hearing scheduled for August 23rd, which is wonderful time in the middle of the summer in August when the community boards are on recess.
Is that the only public hearing?
Well, they've scheduled what they call a community forum on September 12th, but a community forum is not a public hearing. A public hearing is on the record. People can give their comments and, you know, verbally, and then it has to be responded to in the final environmental impact statement. There is no reason why the community forum in September shouldn't also be a public hearing to give more people the opportunity to comment. And the 60-day comment period, let me make a point here, is considering the scale of this project and how long ESDC has been working on this is an insult. 60 days is ridiculously short. By comparison, there's a project that you may be aware of up in the Catskills in the New York City watershed that is proposing to build hotels and golf courses, the Bel Air project. That project had a 140-day public comment period on the DEIS, and New York City DEP was one of the agencies urging an extended public comment period.
And we have to leave it there with Jeff Baker, attorney for Develop, Don't Destroy. Thank you for coming on. And we will speak in a minute to Jim Stuckey, president of the Atlantic Yards Development Group, and he will take your phone calls at 212-433-WNYC or email brianlehrershow@wnyc.org. Brian Lehrer on WNYC. A reminder that next Tuesday we'll try something different in our summer immigration series, The Border. It's a listener's choice segment. We want you to email us and suggest an immigration topic or angle to explore. We will discuss the topic that is suggested the most often. If no topic breaks out as a clear favorite, we'll pick something interesting from among your suggestions. Send your email to brianlehrershow@wnyc.org and put the words listener's choice in the subject line. Again, you can help determine the topic for next Tuesday's installment of our summer immigration series, The Border. We want you to email us and suggest an immigration topic or angle to explore. We will discuss the topic that is suggested the most often. Put the words listener's choice in the subject line. We're talking now about the draft environmental impact statement released by the Pataki administration yesterday for the Atlantic Yards development project they want for Prospect Heights, Brooklyn, including 16 high-rise towers, office, commercial, and residential, and an arena for the Nets. We just heard from an opponent of the project, now an official with Forest City Ratner. In fact, he's president of the Atlantic Yards Development Group, Jim Stuckey. Mr. Stuckey, welcome back to WNYC.
Thank you for having me.
Let me start with some of these environmental impacts. The New York Times says 68 intersections would have significantly more congestion at one or more peak hours. Does that indicate that the project is too big and dense for this neighborhood?
It doesn't indicate that at all. We should really talk about what the EIS is. The EIS, or the Environmental Impact Statement, is a disclosure document, and it's a planning document. And in fact, a great deal of time was taken in the preparation of this document to use it to do just that, to plan. In fact, the EIS looks at 93 total impacts, and it looks at it on 7 different time periods. And in fact, many of those intersections that are examined have many turning movements. So in fact, you're probably looking at over 1,700 different turning movements that occur, and about 8% of those are significant and can't be mitigated. Some of them are in the morning in the rush hour. There's a couple. There are, and we're talking about now in the year 2016, there's one, for example, at 11 o'clock at night on Flatbush and Myrtle Avenue. But more importantly is that we did what we said we were going to do, and is we put together a 15-point transportation plan that is probably more aggressive and progressive than anything that's been done before for a major development project.
You say 2016 because that's when this would be completed built as planned.
That's
right?
When the project is stated to be completed. And more and also important is that the EIS found in examining alternatives that you could substantially reduce the amount of residential development that's proposed for the site, and it wouldn't have a negligible impact at all in terms of the environmental impacts on traffic. And the reason being is that many of the impacts occur because of traffic that's already in the system, or it occurs because of commercial uses that might be built as part of our project. But if you look at one of the alternative plans, the Pacific Plan, which came out of the neighborhood, that plan shows that there are just as many environmental impacts as ours, even though the residential is substantially reduced.
You mean the alternative development that the opponents have proposed?
It's one alternative development. There were actually 5 alternatives that were examined in the EIS in addition to our plan.
But it's not congested enough out there with, you know what traffic's like in that neighborhood without 16 new high-rise buildings, and you're saying it's not going to mean much?
I'm not saying it's not going to mean much. I'm saying I think that traffic is a significant issue, and it has to work for our project as much as it does for anyone else. And the reason that we've gone to great lengths to put together a plan that's very progressive with 15 points, the restructuring of certain intersections, the creation of remote parking with shuttles, the creation of a 400 bike station that allows people to bring bikes and use mass transportation, the agreement that we would subsidize MetroCard use for people who want to come to the arena so that they won't drive, the idea that we'd have high occupancy vehicle parking lots to keep cars from having multiple people who are going to drive to the area are all things that we've done that are very progressive and not done before.
We will take some phone calls for Jim Stuckey, president of the Atlantic Yards Development Group, 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692, or email brianlehrishow@wnyc.org. And by the way, we have put a version that we have of this draft environmental impact statement on our website. I promise this is not the 4,000-page version. So you can just go to wnyc.org and click on Brian Lehrishow if you want to see some of this for yourself. The thousands of new apartments would have enough children to fill a whole additional elementary school and middle school, from what I read. We have a classroom shortage as it is in New York City. Are you offering funding for new school construction?
You know what the EIS found, and again, the EIS is required to look at certain community school districts, and what it found is that by the time the project gets to the second phase, which begins at around the year 2011, there will be a need if you look at the very narrow in area of community school districts 13 and 15, there would be a need to do an elementary and a intermediate school. The EIS basically says that it could be done in any number of ways. One could be on-site. Another could be to use charter schools throughout those school districts. Another could be to create a school in a different area. And another could be to put more students in schools within community districts 13 and 15 that aren't to capacity yet. That's a discussion and a decision that has to ultimately be made by the Department of Education, although we have agreed in Building 5, which is on 6th Avenue and Atlantic Avenue, that we would make space available should the city ultimately decide to put the school at that location.
So you would offer actual space for a school? Is that what you're saying?
What we're saying is that we've designed space to be available. Ultimately, how it gets paid for is a discussion between us and the city based on where they choose to put that location.
Then there would be shadows. Again, according to the Times, new shadows would fall on many existing parks and with a, quote, significant adverse impact, unquote, near the Atlantic Terminal public housing project. Who lives in that housing project?
I want to say that we worked for months with Frank Gehry to find a way to design a shadowless building, and we weren't able to do it. What the EIS does find is that there are, regardless of what you build on the Atlantic Yard site, there will be shadows from buildings. And interestingly enough, one of the things that result from having taller buildings is that you have shadows that are quicker in duration and pass through areas faster. Lower denser buildings, particularly some that would have come from the alternative plans, would have cast shadows as well. And because they were lower and wider and denser, those shadows would have been over the same areas for a much longer period of time.
Lower buildings would cast more intrusive shadows?
Lower, wider buildings, because of the fact that they are a wider building covering a greater space, basically cast shadows that would cover areas for a longer period of time by virtue of the fact that they are wider and the sun is hitting a wider building.
So this one area where it says there's a, quote, significant adverse impact with the shadows near the Atlantic Terminal public housing project, do those people get discounted because they're poor people living in public housing?
No, not at all. In fact, what the EIS also talks about is doing ways of trying to mitigate that impact by working with that housing project, trying to put together increased landscaping and other things that could help to mitigate the impact. It also shows that there's an impact on a local church that's a historic church on 4th Avenue, Church of the Redeemer, and that for a period of time around when there is a church service, there are stained glass windows currently covered up, by the way, and one of the things that we're doing to mitigate that is that we're going to uncover those windows, we're going to clean them, and we're going to find other appropriate ways of lighting them to mitigate that impact.
Jim Stuckey, president of the Atlantic Yards Development Group, my guest on WNYC, and Dina in Brooklyn. You're on WNYC. Hello, Dina.
Hi. I want to give you a real-world example of how this is already overstressing the community. Since April, I live on Fulton and near Fulton and Washington, right on the corner, and they've been digging up here for months, since April, and they have been jackhammering from 6 a.m. to midnight for the past 3 weekends with just current disregard for anything. You know, I can't call the city, I can't, you know, nobody will take a complaint. You know, there's a lady that has a baby downstairs, she couldn't get her kid to sleep. Now that they've finally finished this, for the past 2 nights, there's been electrical fires right under my street corner, and we haven't had power. They're blaming it on the storm last night, but the thing is, it happened the night before. And my neighbors in this that have been in this neighborhood for years say every year this happens when the temperature gets hot.
So are you arguing that the development should not take place because there'll be construction nuisance?
No, I mean, construction, my father's an iron worker. I mean, I couldn't live without construction, you know. It's like, but I'm just saying that they are disregarding. They're just pushing this project through, bullying the people that are already here, and they're not paying attention to what is really sustainable. All right. I lost a night's work last night because I work at home, and, you know, I'm a video editor, and I can't do that.
Mr. Stuckey, what do you say to
Dana? Well, let me just say, I'm not sure what the project is on Fulton and Washington. It's clearly not the Atlantic Yards project, but I understand the issue that's being addressed, and that is the construction impacts that occur. And in fact, when you look at the environmental impact statement, we went to incredible lengths to try and do whatever we could to mitigate construction impacts by having on-site parking, by using equipment with low sulfur fuels, by having high emission standards or filters to basically limit the emissions that go into the air, by creating noise barriers to basically not impact people who are living close into this particular project. And again, I think that we've gone into probably more progressive steps than any other EIS has done before. You know, what can't be lost, though, is that in the course of doing this project, at the end of it, in a city that's growing by a million people between now and 2020, where you have tremendous lack of affordability and affordable housing, at the end of this, we will be creating a significant amount of affordable and middle-income housing. And in order to do that, we obviously have to construct this project.
Here's an email that has a traffic question. It says, living around the corner from Carlton Avenue, I resent very deeply and very strongly that one of the traffic mitigations would be to widen Carlton Avenue, stripping it of its trees and making it another difficult crossing in an area of difficult traffic crossings. What do you say to that person?
Well, I think that there are a number of things that you have to balance, and you have to figure out ways where you have impacts to mitigate those impacts. And I'm not particularly familiar with Carlton Avenue per se, but the widening of that street may in fact be necessary to get cars through it. In terms of stripping of trees, our project will have over 7 acres of new open space. We will be creating an incredibly sustainable project. We'll have the first LEED certified arena in the country. We're going to have 2 million gallons of less polluted water going into the Gowanus Canal in our project is completed as a result of the stormwater management system that we're creating. So this project will have many, many, many benefits from an open space and a sustainability point of view.
Daniel in Prospect Heights, you're on WNYC.
Good morning, Brian. Good morning, Jim. It's Daniel Goldstein. How are you?
Hello, Daniel.
Daniel Goldstein from DDB. I guess I should have figured when I saw Daniel, but Daniel is one of the leading opponents of the project. Go ahead.
Yeah, there's a serious question. This project would be the densest residential community in the United States by almost twice the existing densest community. What is Forest City Radnor's profit on this project that has never been released publicly, and I don't know if it has been privately to government? Can we have that answer?
You know, Daniel, and I know the profit question is asked many times, and what we're not going to do is discuss a profit on a project that hasn't even gone through a public approval process yet. We're a public company. We have annual reports which are put out. There are 10-Ks. There's lots of things that you and others can read in terms of the earnings of Forest City. But in order to get whatever profit we ultimately do make, we also have to spend a tremendous amount of money on infrastructure that the government isn't paying for and that no one else has stepped up to the table to pay for many, many, many years. You know, this area, when we talk about
how can you justify the scale if we don't
One second. But I want to understand and help our listeners understand the profit question. Daniel, I'm going to ask you first, why is it important, why is it relevant to whether the project goes forward or how the project goes forward, how much profit they stand to gain? Briefly.
Two reasons. The MTA's RFP required a 20-year profit loss statement from the developers. Excel gave one. Forest City Radnor did not give one. And we can't understand the justification for such a dense project unless we know what the profit margins are to defend this immense density.
Okay. And Mr. Stuckey, why won't you give us your projected profits? I'm sure you have them.
Well, I'm going to say to you that, number one, we're a private company, but we do have public statements which people will be able to read. Number two, I'm going to say to you is that we are at the very early stage of a project that has not gone through a public approval process yet, is only just starting. I know people think that we've gone through that process because we have, in fact, been out meeting with people for over 2 years before it started. But at the end of the day, until this project is approved, until we see what the ultimate cost of the infrastructure will be, it's very hard for us to be able to make those determinations. But when we are through this process and when this project is built, the information will be very much available through our annual reports. We are a public company.
That's afterwards. But the point that he's trying to make, I guess, is that maybe the project doesn't need to be so dense, therefore with so much impact on the neighborhood, for the company to turn a reasonable profit.
Yeah, it's not a complicated question on density, and you don't really need to go to our profit. In fact, you know, the one thing I think that was interestingly and suspiciously missing from the so-called alternative plans was the cost of how they did those projects and how any developer could make money. There is $650 million worth of public infrastructure that has to be built before the first shovel goes into the ground to build a single affordable housing apartment or the arena or any other part of this project. There's another $350 million of cost money that we will have spent on acquiring land to avoid condemnation and to go through a public process. $1 billion before you start.
I think that's
a very significant investment that does deserve to make a profit. It is, after all, America.
We just have 3 minutes left with Jim Stuckey, president of the Atlantic Yards Development Group. And I need to ask you about eminent domain. The state is backing up your desire to have them use the state's power of eminent domain if necessary. That is to have the government tell people who don't want to sell their homes or businesses to you that they must. Is that a bullying tactic?
No, not at all. You know, let's be clear that this area has been considered blighted since 1968, when the first Atlantic Terminal Urban Renewal Plan was adopted. About 60-65% of this area fell within that urban renewal area and was considered to be a blighted area. Those findings, when the Downtown Brooklyn Plan was approved 2 years ago, were reaffirmed. These are not new. The crime in these areas is substantially higher than areas around it. There are many deteriorated and vacant lots. And, yeah, I know some people will say, gee, Forest City purchased buildings and then they became deteriorated and fell down. But, you know, you can't buy a building a year ago that's brick and stone and have it fall down in a year. These buildings have been vacant, deteriorated, and eyesores going back for many, many, many years.
But the people who own the condos or whatever who don't want to sell certainly don't see their homes as
blighted. Well, but let's be clear about that. We've worked really hard to avoid the use of eminent domain. We've acquired over 90% of the site. We've acquired 94% of all of the rental buildings, all of the owner-occupied buildings. There's only 5 units left. One is Mr. Goldstein, who just came on, and then there are 4 or 5 other brownstones that are owned by people.
But you're saying that you won't release your projected profits because you're a private company, but then you're saying you can use eminent domain because the project is for the public
good. No. The use of eminent domain is being used because the state has found that this is a blighted area in need of redevelopment, and this has been a finding that's existed going back close to 40 years.
We have about a minute left. I want to ask you the same political question that I asked the previous guest who's opposing the project, and that is that this is the lame duck Pataki administration issuing these reports. Do you have reason to think that Elliot Spitzer, if he's elected, would stand by these findings?
I really have no knowledge of what the next governor would say about our project, although I do believe that most of the candidates feel very strongly that the need to take care of affordable housing is a critical agenda item, regardless of who's elected. You know, there are 240,000 people, Brian, who are on Section 8 waiting lists for as long as 8 years trying to get housing. It is a real serious problem, and it's a problem throughout all of Brooklyn. It's not just in this particular area, but in Flatbush and Crown Heights and Sunset Park in Mill Basin, and it's areas all over the city. Housing is critical.
Jim Stuckey, president of the Atlantic Yards Development Group. We've heard both sides. Thank you very much for coming on.
Thank you, Brian.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Wallace Shawn coming up in a minute. Stay with us.